found this new band, Ghost. New to me band, Ghost. And I've got this song stuck in my head. It won't leave my head. It just will not.
Ghost.
Yeah, they're sort of a theatric band. The entire band wears like the same costume. They just have different masks. And the singer is dressed like a pope. Like a satanic pope. Very interesting, but some catchy melodies.
This sounds right for a Swedish rock band.
Yeah, exactly. Super catchy melodies, though.
Those get-ups are pretty awesome.
Yeah, the silver masks are really cool. The chrome ones, like the fake chrome ones. I'd wear one of those around.
I would check this out.
Yeah, it's like not metal at all. I mean, they're like labeled metal, but it's like the same type of metal that like Sabbath, like Black Sabbath would be.
Mm-hmm. When you said ghost, all I could think of was StarCraft Ghost, which I then had to look up and realize that it never came out. It was announced in like 2002, and then I guess the company that was making it had a bunch of delays, and then they got bought out by, I don't know, probably EA or something, and they just never finished it.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, plus it was right at the turn of the console generations. Sorry, at least we got StarCraft 2 out of it.
Yeah.
Eventually.
So what's up? Obviously, you sound under the weather again.
Yeah, I was getting better. I was like almost done with this thing and then just came back and kicked me in the butt yesterday, so.
That sucks.
You're going to power through this. Yeah, it's all right. Hoping that I'm better a week from now when I go on vacation, so that'll be nice.
Where are you going?
So we are going on a pseudo ham radio vacation style, I'm using air quotes, vacation style de-expedition to St. Barthélemy, which is down in the Caribbean, down past Puerto Rico and all that. And
oh, I see. I gotcha. That's cool.
Yeah, that's gonna be nice, and maybe the moist air, the warm air will do me some good there. I took the forecast every day is high of 86, low of 74, and sunny every day.
That sounds nice.
Can't wait.
It was nice today. Jamie took Watson to the office, so I didn't have to babysit him all day. And I just went outside and sat in the sun and worked for a while, and it felt really good.
It's that California weather tax.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully that the air does you some good. I guess that's why Paul was talking about the flight simulator videos on YouTube for St. Barts. And I didn't know that flight simulator YouTube was a thing. I mean, I should know by now that there's a YouTube like subculture for anything. But I got quite a few kicks today watching some of those videos. So for anyone that doesn't know, I guess St. Barts has like a really small airport, like airstrip, and the landing strip is like the runway is like right behind a hill basically. So it's like a pretty small plane. They have a size limit on planes that can land there, and it's pretty small. So all these people on YouTube are loading up these flight simulators, and they're like, "Can we land a 747 on this thing?" And it's really it's really entertaining to watch.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's hard enough just to land a small plane there. I mean, the guys that do it are professionals, obviously. You have to have special permits and stuff, I think, to even fly in there because it's so difficult. And yeah, there's this huge mountain on one side, and the runway is only, I think, 2,400 feet or something like that. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, it looked pretty wild. I don't think I'd want to fly in on that. I guess like if a pro's doing it, but yeah, these YouTube pilots were having a good time flying the biggest plane they could possibly fly from the simulator and just seeing if it'll work. I think most of them just went into the ocean.
Yeah, pretty much. It's pretty funny though, because even if you could, well, yeah. So even with some of the big planes were landing, the wings and the engines were like scraping along the buildings on the outside.
Right.
And stuff.
I think one plane hit a bunch of people that were so on this hill that you have to fly over. There's a road that goes across it, and cars are just driving by on the simulator, and there's people just looking at the ocean from the hill. And the 747 comes by and clips everyone standing there on the way down. So it sort of like bounced. It hit the hill and then bounced back in the air and then landed on the runway.
That was pretty funny. I stand corrected. 2,100 feet.
Yeah, I mean that number means nothing to me, but it must be pretty small.
It's damn short. That's like you can land a small plane in about half that, but that's about as short as I will go flying.
Right.
That's what I'm comfortable with. I've landed on that length successfully multiple times, but any shorter than that, I start to get a little iffy.
That sounds wild to me.
So it's been a week over here.
Like a full week, like a work week, like a productive week. What kind of week are we talking about?
Just a all over the place week. I mentioned one of my goals for 2020 was to spend time with doing quality of life improvements for the business, you know, including refactoring the app and doing all this other stuff. But I'm trying to work on removing all these different pain points that we have in our process for just managing all the different hardware and software and devices that we have to keep track of. One of the things that has been really, really good for us is using OpenVPN, because all of our, we've got, you know, over 30 different Mac minis and Raspberry Pis all over behind NATs and double NATs and all this crappy internet and stuff. But having OpenVPN is really nice because it allows us to get into those devices without having to punch holes in ports and do all that whole thing. And it allows us to, you know, if IP address changes, we don't care about that kind of stuff.
Sure. Okay.
The thing about OpenVPN is it's a real pain in the butt to manage. And I've been learning and reading a lot about WireGuard lately, which is a, from what I can tell, a relatively new VPN application. Seems to run on everything. They're rolling it into Linux kernel soon, so it'll be available natively in Linux. And WireGuard is just really, really easy to simple to set up because it doesn't involve certificates and private keys and all these crazy config files and stuff. Basically, it's designed for really, really simple use cases. And in order to set it up, all you need is a public key and private key pair, just like you're setting up an SSH connection.
Okay.
And WireGuard is inherently sort of peer-to-peer. There's no really server or client architecture. It's just the same application runs everywhere. It just depends on how you configure it. And so I got WireGuard running on one of our servers, and I sort of configured it as a server so you can connect to it, and then it routes all the traffic to all the clients. And it's been great. Like, it's just, again, it's just really, really easy to set up. It's fast. It doesn't have a lot of overhead in terms of traffic. It's just been really, really nice to work with. And so that's one of these pain points that I've been trying to remove, because, like I said, I do it infrequently enough that I kind of forget how to do it. I have to read the docs every time.
Right.
And that's just not a great place to be.
Yeah, that is, especially because usually when you have to go back and make adjustments to those things, it's sort of like a, not necessarily an emergency situation, but you're probably like in a hurry or you have to do something quickly. And so having to go back and look at the docs and re-remember how everything works, it's never the best situation to be in.
Yeah, and so of course the next logical step is, all right, how can I make this even easier on myself in the future? So what better way than to write a Greenfield Phoenix LiveView app, right? That's the first thing that comes to mind, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
So what I did was made a new Phoenix app. It's on Elixir 1.10, OTP 22, all the latest, greatest versions of everything, LiveView 0.6. And what it does is I actually started up with no Ecto support. And is this application that lets you manage these peers. So it can shell out to the WireGuard commands and create private keys and public key pairs. I wrote a very, very simple, naive parser or encoder and decoder for the config files. So basically this entire application is just backed by like a config text file. There's no database or anything.
Oh, that's cool.
And it, yeah. So I load this config file into memory, convert it to Ecto embedded schemas, and I have a live view thing that lets me see the status of everything. And I can, it automatically knows, you know, what IP address to assign to new clients, creates a public and private key pair, has a little JavaScript hook. So when you click on it, you can copy right to your clipboard. And man, it's just really, really nice. And so that was like just a really perfect example of this thing where I needed this little bit of interactivity for this stupid in-house application. Didn't want to spend the time doing a whole front-end, back-end thing. It's good enough for internal use. I'm not really planning on open-sourcing it or making it available, so I didn't spend a lot of time polishing the back-end, but I did just enough to get it working well. And you know, I'm really happy with it. That's just, it was just really, really cool little project that basically went exactly as I expected. When does that happen ever?
That is kind of a cool use case for it. I mean, you use Phoenix and LiveView because you're really familiar and you're able to knock it out, right? Like you said, you're not using any sort of database. It's pretty simple. Is that why you chose Phoenix and LiveView? It's just because you're so familiar with them at this point?
Yeah, exactly. It goes back to what we were talking about last week about being familiar with the tools and like you're really good at what you do the most.
Yeah. So to piggyback on that idea, I'm sort of working on a greenfield application over here. It's still going to be using the Design Collective API as a whole, but we've had this idea for like a sister business or sister application for a while. And I started on that this week, and obviously I'm using the same tools. So, and our entire front end, so for DK, for this new thing, for our sales website, everything, it's all Nuxt.js across the board. And originally I was kicking around the idea of, you know, I didn't want to go through all the BS of like writing all the boilerplate stuff. So I wanted to pick a UI framework off of the shelf and try to use that. And there's a few good ones for Vue specifically, like Bootstrap Vue.js is really good. And also Bootstrap Vue.js comes with web types and everything. So specifically with WebStorm or IntelliJ, like you get complete auto completion down to slots, props, attributes, everything for all of the components in the whole library. And that was cool. So what ended up happening was I was like, all right, I'm going to use Bootstrap Vue on this. It's going to be fine. This is business to business. It doesn't have to be like custom designed. And even the first release of this is just for internal use only sort of thing happening. So it doesn't, you know, like Bootstrap will be fine for this. And I ended up banging my head on the wall for, you know, 2 days. Anytime I wanted to do something, I had to go and look up and check documentation or look for examples of like Bootstrap websites that were done well or apps that were done well. And that's difficult because anytime you search anything Bootstrap, you get 100,000 listicles in the responses or like abandoned websites. So I went back on my idea of not wanting to write some boilerplate stuff, installed Tailwind. And a day later, I had everything I needed. So like I wrapped up all the basic form inputs. Like, you know, I have a base input and a base input control. And so input controls wrap like the label and the help text and the error text and the form validation and everything. So I have controls for inputs, text areas, checkboxes, selects, everything I really need. And again, it took me maybe a day and a half to put all that together. And now I'm just like flying through this application.
Now you spend a lot of time sort of surveying all the different front end libraries out there, right? You mentioned Bootstrap. You looked at a couple of other ones as well. You kind of solicited from our Discord as well. Why didn't you end up going with something out of the box?
Just because, you know, for the reasons that you were saying before, like I know Tailwind so well, I'm just used to working with it. So switching to something different just caused a lot of friction. So even you like switching back to using Tailwind or like a custom setup adds more work to my plate. It's more work I can fly through with less friction, if that makes sense. So pulling something like Bootstrap Vue or Elements UI, which is another one I looked at, yeah, they have so many components in there, but I don't need 80% of them, and I'm not familiar with the API at all. So that was probably one of the biggest deciding factors. Was because, yes, there's more work, but I can get through it faster because there's less friction involved in that work. And also I could take a lot from DK for what we've already written there because, again, it's Nuxt and Tailwind. So I could kind of share some of the work there. But another reason why I decided to go back to the Tailwind route or to keep things completely consistent across all fronts is because we have Drew and we have another contractor named Jaggy who's been working with me, and they're both familiar with Nuxt and Tailwind, but they don't know Bootstrap or Element UI or whatever else. So not only would I have been adding friction to my own workflow, but I would have had to force that on them essentially if they wanted to help me out on this project. That, like, those are the two biggest reasons why I decided to not use something off the shelf. And I think what's also been really beneficial, I didn't really think about this up front, but because I'm using Tailwind now, you know, like I said, I can pull some code from DK, but also I think like I've made a lot of improvements on how this app is structured. I've learned a ton since working on DK. You know, obviously DK was never really a greenfield app for me, even though we did end up splitting the single server side rendered app into client and API. We had a bunch of Vue already that was used in the server side rendered API, so that wasn't even really like a real greenfield app. So I've been able to, well, it's been almost 4 years now, I've been able to take like the 4 years of learning and apply that to this fresh project. And so things are like super clean, super organized, like super minimal dependencies. And I've already isolated places where I can take the new like setup and push it back over to DK and make DK better. And I don't think I would have found those things had I not sort of spun up a brand new app and kicked the tires on that a little bit. I think like my work with DK is always sort of collared because I'm always in that world of things already existing, if that makes sense.
So we talked about this a little, but what was your reasoning for doing the Greenfield app in the first place versus just using the existing DK stuff? I mean, you've already got all the tooling stuff in place there and all the styles and everything. Why wouldn't you just add this as another set of pages into the DK front end app?
Yeah, so this is actually a separate business, or it will be. So it's been an interesting project, right? So essentially what we're working on is a sister application to DK. So how it basically works is this new app that we're standing up controls a certain domain of logic and data, and it's sort of encapsulated in its own right. And going forward in the future, this application will be its own thing. It'll have its own domain. It'll have its own customer base, everything like that going forward. It's just that Design Collective happens to be the first sort of consumer of that data, and it consumes directly because they're living next to each other. I can talk more about the architectural, like how I'm approaching that stuff if you want to later. But the reason why we decided to split it out now, because like you mentioned, for this project I've been talking about for a while, like the vendor system I've mentioned, I've been sort of building some stuff into a company dashboard in the back end for Design Collective. And while that might work for the first release, I'll have to move that out eventually anyway, as this sister company or business starts standing up more. So I decided to, while things are simple enough now, just go ahead and do it. Go ahead and separate it out. Go ahead and make it his own thing now, as opposed to waiting for things to get more complicated and waiting for things to be live before doing that.
So do you have any shared resources or code or anything between the two projects, or is it just the API that's being shared?
Just the API that's being shared. So again, it's like its own thing, right? So they'll like DK and this thing will work together, but this thing is like its own thing. It's like the branding colors can be totally different. We can style it differently if we want to. It's totally not officially affiliated, I guess. Like it's not gonna, you know, the sales website won't talk about Design Collective. Design Collective sales website won't talk about this other thing, if that makes sense. It's just that this other thing is solving a lot of problems that we have for Design Collective as a business. And so we're like, hey, maybe this will solve problems for other people as well. So let's put it out there as another business, if that makes sense, as opposed to trying to fit it under the Design Collective umbrella.
Isn't that so frustrating when you have this great new application that's nice and clean, it's using all your latest and greatest knowledge, and then you have to go back into DK and and look at all the corrupt? It's so frustrating. Like you just want to tear it all up and start over.
A little bit, yeah. But I don't know, it makes me feel good about stuff. I think my first reaction was like, oh, I actually know how to do this. It's not, it's different. So like when Jaggy comes in and, you know, I'm kind of explaining to him stuff and like, I might say like, oh, I'm sorry, this is disorganized. And he's like, this is not nearly as bad as you think it is. You know, one of those situations where you always look at what you made and you're like, this sucks. And someone else looks at it and it's like, it's not that bad, you know? So for whatever reason, I have a better outlook. I don't feel as frustrated with DK as I do, or as I once did, I suppose, after looking at this stuff. But it feels good because it feels like like you said, I did a lot of surveying and looking at different libraries. Like, is there something new I can use? Do I want to replace something? Is there something about DK's front end that I didn't like that I want to get rid of? And up to this point, I've tried to keep everything really the same. So our like form validation library is the same. It's just a newer version. I haven't added a lot of dependencies to this yet. I'm trying to see like how far we can get without adding a bunch of cruft to it. So, for example, I tested out Vue Apollo because our API is GraphQL based. So I was testing on Apollo, and it's such a heavy dependency, and it does so much stuff. It's sort of like a big magic box. Like, it has its own built-in cache that you can use. It does a lot of smart things for you, which is nice. But I started thinking about it, and I was like, well, this MVP is really simple. I don't need Apollo right now. And if I start using this cache, then I have to start worrying about, okay, well, what happens if data that gets cached on the client is updated on the server? Then I have to implement some sort of pub sub or connection like across the board. And I want to do that. So I guess really like what I'm trying to do is keep it as simple as I can and as similar to the DK app as I can. So that way, like Drew and Jaggy and whoever else can hop back and forth and work on things and be relatively familiar.
And it's like you said, you don't need the whole everything in the kitchen sink. You kind of, this application is pretty limited in scope. You not kind of know what form control is going to need. And listen, making components that you can compose in Vue.js, it's really good at that. And they make it really, really easy, right?
Yeah.
It might feel like reinventing the wheel, but you do get all that flexibility that you can't get otherwise. And with Tailwind, you know, being able to style everything exactly how you want it, that's really powerful. Yeah, I don't blame you for going that route.
I mean, like you said, composing, composing your components together is really easy. And specifically, I hadn't made like a, I guess what they call like a transparent wrapper. So let's say you have like a form input, like an actual input element. You typically have a label and like help text and error text and different things associated with that input. So what people normally do is they wrap that all in a component. So you might have like a base input component. And then what you have to do is you have to make sure that like attributes like vModel and different events and stuff are synced from your input, because if you have a Vue component and you add an attribute onto the component, typically it gets added to the root element in the component. So let's say that your base input component is wrapped in a div, because every component can only have one child. So you might have a div with a label, an input, and a span, for example. So before, maybe it was Vue 2.6, but before you had to sort of like hijack some props and handle like the data coming back and forth. So that way, if you put vModel on your wrapper component, the inside the wrapper component, you'd have to like take that prop and then emit the event up with the new data, right? With Vue 2.6, again, I'm pretty sure this happened in 2.6, but there's an attribute called inherit adders, and you can set that to false. And what that means is that if you just put attributes on your component when you're using it, those don't just automatically go to the parent of the component. You can actually specify which element in your component inherit any attributes added to the instance of that component. Did that make any, like, how I described that, did that make sense?
Yeah, that totally does make sense, and I wish I had known about that sooner, because that's really powerful. So basically, when you add attributes to the component, instead of just sticking them on the root, which is mostly what you want in the most cases, for form controls, those form controls are nested really deeply in there, and really, that's what you want to add the attributes to, especially for vModel.
Exactly. So when you're using your base input component, you slap vModel on that. So vModel is a shorthand for vbind value and an input event in change. So basically like getter and setter, right? And so when you put that on your component instance, you have to bind that, you have to pass that off to your actual input element. And your input element is not going to be the root element, could be in divs or whatever, like you said, deeply nested. And so setting inherit adders to false makes that really easy. And there's also another thing you can do to components that I just learned about. So you can actually specify ModEl. So when you specify the ModEl, you can say like what prop and what event it emits. So by default, I believe, when you add vmodel to a component, it adds a prop, a vbind prop for value specifically. And I think it looks for, let me look this up. Vue.js vmodel. Yes. Okay. So when you add vmodel to a component, it automatically binds a prop value for you and automatically sets an event watcher for an input event for you. And so again, that needs to be passed through to the child component, but this model attribute you can set on a component, you can change that stuff. So you can say model prop is checked and event is update. And so that way you can just make this work on a checkbox, because naturally, you know, a checkbox doesn't emit an input event. It emits a checked event or a change event. Sorry. So in the model, you can actually say the value here is checked and the event is change, and it'll just work. You don't have to do anything funny with computed props or anything like that.
Yeah, I do remember seeing that one. That's been in there a while, and that makes sense, because I think they probably had to use it internally for checkboxes and stuff like that, and drop downs and all the ones that don't have, I mean, there's no input event in HTML, so
right exactly. So by changing the default, like, if so, instead of having it always be V on input, you can say V on update, and that way you can still bind to the actual DOM's input event, and that way you're not overriding, so you can get that if you need it. Which
that makes sense.
Yeah, which works really well. So with those two things combined, I mean, once I learned that, so I learned that from Chris Fritz's enterprise boilerplate repo. I'll link that in the show notes, but it's like a killer repository. Everything's really well commented. And he has a base input component in there that explained this. And as soon as that like clicked in my mind, I was like, oh, this is really easy. So, you know, within a couple hours, I had input text area, checkbox, select, number inputs, radio buttons, all these different base inputs that I needed, and they were all implemented, all reactive. They all just work. And I was like, okay, well now I can build the UI, I guess. Like, these are, you know, the basic components that I need are all already put together. They're wrapped. I know exactly how they work. I'm not having to consult, you know, someone else's documentation or design guidelines or anything like that. I can just start running with it. So, you know, inside of like 2.5 days, we have an app now where Jaggy and I are both working on it. You can sign in with your DK account and you can actually edit and update products. And Jaggy's already like implemented a portion of the vendor import UI for importing CSVs.
That's wild, man. And this is all possible because you had that GraphQL endpoints to begin with, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, because this app can share the GraphQL endpoint, or it will be, we didn't have to, like, all of the work we've done up to this point in the vendor product project. I mean, the queries and mutations don't have to change at all. Maybe the namespace will change in Elixir, but the interface to the outside world hasn't changed at all. So, all I really did was like, here's what we did for the DK app. Let's pull this over. And that was that. So I don't even think we ended up using, we referenced some of the UI that we built into the DK backend for the vendor stuff, but I don't think we actually used any of the code, because by the time we got to that point, we're like, well, we're almost already there. So there's no use, like, there's no reason to pull those in and like restyle them and everything. So, just hit the ground running with that. And really, like you said, I haven't touched Elixir all week. I haven't had to change a single thing. Like, mutations, queries, nothing's changed.
That's great, man. Glad to hear that you feel like you're being productive.
Yeah, and I think that was my biggest struggle. Like, yeah, I probably would have got there with Bootstrap Vue, but who knows how long it would have taken me. Because, again, having, like, Bootstrap is a big framework. There's a lot of stuff there. And especially Bootstrap Vue, with all the extra interactivity that is in it, it's just a lot.
Plus, you're going to end up with something that looks like Bootstrap, which is so 2017.
So what I ended up doing was, I've been on the Tailwind UI mailing list for a while.
Yeah, those emails from Adam Wathen are great. They're really funny and awesome.
They're great, yeah. So they basically, what they do, if you don't get those, he puts together a few different UIs. So like, one was like an email inbox, one was like a Kanban board. He'll build them in Tailwind and just say like, all right, here's a preview of, you know, some of the stuff we'll be offering in Tailwind UI. And so I just jacked one of the app frames from that and tossed it into Vue and just started building on it.
I actually stole some ideas just visually from one of those emails as well for my WireGuard app that I was talking about before. I didn't steal any code, but I liked some of the design, so I just took some of the elements.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's essentially what I did was, like, I like that layout, and I like the colors, so I'm just going to build off of that for now. We can change them later if I need to pretty easily, but hit the ground running, and yeah, like I said, we've had some really good progress, and, you know, the initial release of this thing is just going to be, like, an internal tool at while we build out the rest of the features for it. So that'll give us like some time to dog food it and test it and make changes if we need to there towards the design and things like that. But I feel like we're in a really good place. And again, I think, you know, having the experience of working on DK for so long and being frustrated with certain things, being able to fix those up front in this new application has been huge. So a lot less repetitive markup having to be copied and pasted, more thought going into, this is an application, so we have to think about building it like an application. So like in Design Collective, in like say the store admins, there's not like, we don't have any sort of like page wrapper components or anything like that. There's just sort of lots of repeated markup, and going back and pushing them into components would be fine, but it's just, you know, it's not that important enough. So going into Sidedoor or the new application, I was like, okay, well, let's think about how we can like hide some of this markup. And so now we have like a page wrapper that has a couple of slots. So I think like one thing that has made this a lot easier for me to work with was I'm using slots way more than in Design Collective. So instead of, we were barely using slots for anything, I think, in Design Collective. So instead of going that approach, we have lots of little wrapper components that expose slots and expose places where you can be like, oh, you can put a button in top right, you can put a button in the bottom right, you could, you know, put content here, you could put content there. So it's sort of like it's sort of like giving you a shell, and then you poke holes in it, and you're like, okay, you can put content in one of these three spots, and then using that across the board. And that's been really nice to work with so far. So trying to also improve on things conceptually. And what's hilarious is that, in my mind, I was like, oh, this is really cool. This is, this is something I think that could work really well. And I just want to make sure I'm not going to sort of program myself into a corner by making things too restrictive via components. And so I messaged a couple of people and was like, hey, what do you think about this idea? And one of my friends was like, oh, you mean like, Django templates or, what's another one, Blade, or where you say like you have a layout and you say, oh, this block is for the body, this block is for the menu. And I was like, oh, that's exactly what I'm doing. Never mind. it's already a very well known thing, but for whatever reason, it just didn't click in my mind. Like that's, you know, there's already a pattern for this.
And using the sweet new slot syntax.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, it's been quite a week for me too. Feeling really productive, which feels nice. I don't feel like I felt that productive in a while.
That's good. Greenfield projects, low hanging fruit. That's always a, you know, good feeling. You're not going to be able to continue at that pace, obviously. But starting out, it's nice that you don't have those roadblocks of, you know, sometimes it's hard to get started because you have to set up all the dependencies and figure out what tools to use. And, you know, you did spend some time making all those decisions, but you kind of settled on what you already knew anyways. So there was actually basically no startup cost.
Right. And I think part of that enthusiasm too is I really actually believe in this idea. Like, not that I don't believe in Design Collective, but there's a lot of challenges with the target, like the demographic that Design Collective is targeting. You know, a lot of stores, it feels bad to even talk about them this way because they're not lazy. They're just not used to doing business in a digital world. And so they also have other businesses too. So their store, most furniture owners don't just own a store. They own a design business, a manufacturing business. They're really busy. So it's difficult to nail people down and be like, all right, we need you to do A, B, and C. And in fact, if you just put up like a really well-designed flow for a store onboarding, they still wouldn't finish it because half the time when we sit down to help them get through their onboarding, they they haven't brought their, you know, so like they have to create a Stripe account. And so Stripe's going to ask them for like their tax ID numbers and their business, their, you know, information about like legal information about their business. And it's striking, like it's pretty striking. Like half the people are like, oh, I have to go find that stuff. I don't have that right now. We're not ready to actually go through this process. Right. So that's been where the majority of the challenge has been for Design Collective, is actually like pinning people down and getting them through onboarding, really. So the sister app, you know, it's going to solve some other business things for Design Collective, but also the target demographic for that, they're already used to using software. So it should be a lot easier to get people through.
And you can design it a little bit differently then too. You can kind of anticipate that and design it to be a little more like a developer or yeah, like a database or something, where it's might not be, it doesn't have to, you know, win a design award.
Oh yeah. I mean, especially the first iteration, it's only an internal, it's like a data intensive internal app. So it doesn't, we don't have to use design to like convince someone to buy something anyway, which feels good. And at the core, the application itself is not competing with companies that have $1 billion. So that also feels really nice. So there's, I don't know, I think there's a lot of benefits to it. So I think that's what partly is fueling the excitement and fueling the feeling of, you know, productivity, I guess, in this. And I guess that's one thing that I've been missing for a while is I enjoy working on Design Collective, but I haven't had the level of excitement that allows you to focus for like multiple hours on end without having to like concentrate on that, if that makes sense.
I mean, listen, you've been working on the same project for 4 years and you've grown it. And of course, it's always going to be exciting to do something new. You got to do something new at some point.
Yeah. 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 I guess.
Even if it is, you know, tangentially related, it's still different enough that it's something new.
Right. And I think the other part of it too is that this also, we're going into this having all of the experience of the last 4 years of working on Design Collective and working on a software business. We didn't have that knowledge and that experience when we first started working on Design Collective. Like when I showed up, I had made MVPs before, but I've never tried to like grow a business, you know? And so, you know, we're not stopping working on Design Collective. We're actually, you know, hopefully the new application in tandem, they can grow together because they're sort of symbiotic. I think like having that experience of working on this thing too, it makes a lot of decisions a lot easier. And so there's less drag there. I mean, I'm still like, you know, I spent 2 days looking at some of the tech stuff and evaluating those decisions. But I guess what Jaggy said to me maybe frames it up really well, because he's been working on this other part of the project. And he said it felt really good to work on a project where the business goals and ideas were clearly laid out in front of him. And so he knew exactly what he needed to deliver. And that felt really good to hear, because I think that speaks to the last 4 years of experience and making mistakes and everything. And then channeling that experience into how we're framing this project going forward.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Plus, he's just excited about Elixir. He's been saying that he's been wanting to work with Elixir for a couple of years now. So
that's great. Get them in there a little bit at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. We pulled them away from Laravel. He said Phoenix or bust to me yesterday, so.
Oh, man. He's drinking the Kool-Aid.
He drank the Kool-Aid. Yep. Yeah, I think, like, a lot of stuff just, he's been really excited about. Like, when he ran the test suite, he was like, you guys have 1,053 tests, I think. And he was like, 1,000 tests? It's like, yeah, but it's not that slow. Like, I thought he was going to be like, this is going to take forever to run these tests. But apparently he was blown away. So the 1,000-some tests run in less than 3 minutes on his laptop. And we're like, I'm hardly even running any of the tests async, and a lot of them are touching the database. So there could be a lot of work done there to speed things up. But he was like, are you kidding? Because he was telling me that another app he worked on with Laravel that had a similar number of tests took a half an hour to run them all.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and the last Rails app I worked on before DK, I think there was a couple hundred tests, and it took about 5 minutes to run. So we're not doing too bad with 1,000 tests in under 3 minutes.
So I had a not-so-great experience with Nuxt and Vue.js this week.
Uh-oh.
nothing with the tooling. Completely my fault.
What happened?
Well, I've been working internally on this new feature that we've been talking about this feature since basically day one of the business. And so it was really, really eager to get it out in front of people. And what this feature does is basically let you use one type of radio that you have sitting on your desk to control a different, totally different brand of radio sitting far away in the remote station. Normally it's like, if you want to use type of radio A, you have to have the component, you know, that's the same brand to control it.
Mm-hmm.
But this, what I basically wrote was this kind of interoperability layer where it translates the commands between one type of the other and back and forth. So in theory, like, you just power up this thing and it syncs up the state between them, and then you can actually use this totally other brand of stuff to control pretty much anything, which is cool. It opens up lots of doors. But anyway, it's really nice because we've been migrating to these new radios, but we don't want to leave the guys hanging who have laid out money and bought all this specialized equipment, and then, like, we're going to make that go away. That's not a great experience for them, right? It's not fair.
Right.
I proposed one of the options of just buying them all out. Just just paying them, be like, here, just give it to us. And that's not a really feasible idea, though.
Yeah.
Anyway, suffice to say, I pushed this change, and it broke a whole bunch of other stuff. Even though I was testing it pretty, you know, a lot, and I had been kind of had it in the wings for a while. Just, you know how these things go. You just put it in production and the world starts ending.
Yeah, I do know about that.
Yeah. So, but luckily for this change, it was 100% client side. Didn't require any server side changes. It was just in the Nuxt application. Actually, I should back up and clarify that, because the way we actually do this is, when you're working with hardware, you have to be using our little Electron app.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the only way that we can communicate outside of the browser sandbox, right? We can talk to processes and serial ports and TCP and UDP and all that stuff. But all that code doesn't actually even live in the Electron app. The Electron app is just a pretty, really thin shell that has very few features in it. All the code is actually pulled down from Netlify, even though it's technically, quote-unquote, native, like, Electron code.
Mm-hmm.
We just conditionally evaluate it. So if you're on the web browser, we just don't even look at those files. But if we're in the Electron app, we load all those files, and then they have access to all the Electron APIs.
Okay.
Which is really, really powerful, because I don't have to push updates to the Electron app whenever I want to make changes to hardware code. I just push up to Netlify, and it just pulls it down just like a regular update.
Right. Like anytime you go to one of those sites where a banner pops up saying, hey, there's a new content or an update, click here to refresh. Essentially cache busing, right?
Right. But what's cool about it, again, is that the code is written to only run, it requires Electron, but we just don't even evaluate it if you're in the browser, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Anyway, so I pushed this code and started getting tickets coming in. It was like dinner time, so I really wanted to look at it, right? It's the worst. So I just went on Netlify, went to the deploys screen, clicked on my previous good deploy from a month ago, said deploy this version, and it was done. I just rolled it back that simply.
That's awesome.
And then it made everyone refresh. You know, that little banner shows up and they refresh, and it actually downgraded everything. But man, it was just, had to have that ability was really, really nice, and it just buys me some more time to, you know, actually fix the bug. I'm not concerned that's a show-stopping bug. I just didn't have time to fix it at that moment, right? And I didn't want, it was just causing more problems than anything.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's something I have relied on in the past for Heroku, and another reason why I haven't left Heroku is because if something does bomb, I can just roll back that release. Even if it's the Elixir app, I can just roll it back and it'll be fine. Provided I haven't done any database migrations in that release, because that would be a nightmare if I had to roll that back. That's a whole nother issue, right? But that's one reason why I stick around, because that's something that's really nice. Like, hopefully you don't need it a lot, but if you do need it, you know, it comes in very handy.
Yeah, 100%. Like I said, I was lucky this time that it was isolated to just a client only change, so I didn't have to worry about coordinating a rollback of the server and the client. I could just literally one click in Netlify, and the old version is live instantly.
that instantly is pretty cool. Like, that happens that fast. I think with Heroku, it has to do another deploy or something. Maybe it might just swap the slug out, but I don't think it's that fast.
Yeah, this was, you didn't even have to do the deploy. It just pointed it at the old version. Yeah, it's crazy.
That's cool. So they must keep the slug. By slug, I mean like the generated, the compiled version of the app in a
cache somewhere. Yeah, they must keep it around somewhere.
Yeah, that's cool.
So not a great experience, but also a great experience.
It's got to be good peace of mind. Did you happen to do it from your mobile device too, or?
No, I wasn't that desperate.
Okay. That's pretty cool. That feels good. I think for like solo devs like us, having tools like that is priceless.
Yeah, it really is. It really, really is. I'm looking forward to the day when I can get everything on GigaElixir. And that'll be just one fewer thing I have to worry about.
And you're talking GigaElixir specifically because of hot reloading and stuff that they provide or they support?
No. I meant for in terms of like things you mentioned, like doing rollbacks and easy deploys and clustering and all that stuff is like just, you know, they call it Heroku for Elixir, right?
Oh, yeah, just yeah, yeah.
Being able to get all those features out of the box there.
Yeah, sorry, that's nice. That's what I mean. Like the GigaElixir specifically because they support OTP, plus they have all of the Heroku-ish things. Yeah, that would be nice to move DK over there now that I think about it, because then I could actually really use like ETS and stuff. although OBAN has been really, really cool. So I got into the OBAN UI beta. And OBAN UI, so like OBAN is a task background job runner for Elixir, but it's backed by Postgres. So we've been using that. So we don't use Redis or anything for our production app. We just use OBAN. And he's building Parker. Shout out to Parker. He's building OBAN UI, which is a live view based real time dashboard akin to, I can't remember what the Laravel one is, Nova maybe. But anyway, he got me into the beta, so I deployed it, and now I have a live view powered dashboard that I can see jobs are running in real time. And because it's backed by Postgres, I have historical data, and we keep 100,000 jobs around. So I can go back and see the results of all 100,000 of the jobs that have run previously.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it has like a live search. It has filtering by the worker. It has like you can look at all the running jobs down to like the worker node that's running them, and it's really cool. It's really, really cool. Really well done. I'll put a link to that in the show notes because he actually has a demo. Have you seen the demo yet?
I've seen some screenshots.
Oh well, hold on. I wanna see what your reaction is. Click on this link I'm about to send you. Again, I'll put this in the show notes too, but. This is a demo of like bogus jobs basically running, but this is exactly how it works on Design Collective right now.
This is pretty cool.
Pretty cool. But yeah, anyway, it's been great. I like it. I like it a lot.
The only thing about this is that, yeah, yeah. You go to click on something and it changes out from under your cursor. That always drives me batty.
Oh yeah. Hashtag it's beta. It's beta.
I'm just saying in general, it's a hard problem to solve.
Yeah, but I mean, I should probably let you go and let you get some rest, recuperate, recover.
It's a race between when we finish recording and when the NyQuil kicks in.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm glad that you're hitting the ground running with your new app and looking forward to seeing it here. You got to send me some screenshots or something because it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, it feels good, man. But yeah, I should let you go. But if anyone has any feedback or questions or comments or would like to see more screenshots or talk about the view, like the various libraries up there for view and stuff, I'll probably be putting together a blog post soon about more of like the moving pieces and individual pieces for how this app is being built. But if you'd like to talk about it, hit us up.
You can send us tweets at DNCcast. Sean is Sean Washbot. I am Shrockwell.
And as always, the show notes will be available at dnc.show. So anything we talk about today and anything we mentioned, anything I just actually feel like putting in the show notes, they'll be there. You can see them at dnc.show.
Put that band Ghost in there.
Oh, that's right.
The song you're listening to.
I'll make a note.
We'll also post those over on spectrum.chat where you can have real-time discussion with us, do the show notes, say hi.
And as always, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out in the world and supporting us. So thank you, everyone at Spec.